We've got a special guest, the startup Sprocket. You guys introduce yourselves and get started.
I'm Sven Schrugen, founder, designer.
I'm Alex Baltoff, co-founder, back-end guy, sometimes front-end guy, tech guy.
Wear many hats. Yeah. If you have to.
I'm Dustin Baer. I do front-end for Android.
And so you guys all went to school together.
Different schools.
Different
went to high school with this guy, believe it or not, and we reconnected at a party later on.
Yeah.
And this guy, I'm a former alumni of his college, so we both went to Cogswell College.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of an interesting, you know, you guys took something just right out of school and ran with it. How'd you guys get started?
I'm a professional UI UX designer, and during my spare time as a hobby, I was building bikes for friends and having a really hard time doing form archaeology to try to figure out compatibility and specs and standards to put these bikes together. So I wanted to provide a solution for myself as well as others. So I founded the company in beginning of 2014, kind of been going ever since. Surprised and delighted at how much progress we've made so far.
Cool. So how did you guys start working on this project all together? Or how did you guys, you know, what kind of started the wheels clicking? Gears, sprockets clicking?
Sprockets clicking. Well, for a long time it was just me, and the kind of footwork I was doing originally was setting up the trademark, getting placeholder apps in both app stores, getting the social media presence online with our Instagram blog, which now has 36,000 followers. And because I'm very much a front-end designer, I needed the experience of somebody like Alex to really flesh out the back-end. And he's a generalist that really understands a lot of different systems at a deep level beyond my capacity. So it was really with his coming on board that we were able to start making this project a reality.
Yeah, we were connected at a party, as Sven said. And he said, I'm looking for an Android guy. And my UI class in college was Android, and I was really interested in it. And then turns out he wanted to do a distributed client server system, so I became a server guy.
Yeah.
Which, you know,
you're learning a lot.
I'm learning a lot, but I also had like the kind of necessary broad background from my major to kind of be able to do this. So.
And it's as you do it, you learn it,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of refine what you need to know to make
yeah.
it actually happen.
I've actually had to dig into this as well because I taught myself database design. I just checked out a whole bunch of books in the library and started reading. So we worked out the database architecture together.
Yeah.
At some point.
And so, when you started, what resources did you utilize? I mean, you guys said you used BizSpark. How did that go down?
Again, through college connection at Cogswell College, I interned with my buddy Tobias Marks, who you know, who's a
mm-hmm.
video game evangelist at Microsoft. So it was through interactions with him that at some point I ended up going to a hackathon at Microsoft for VR where I met Dustin, where then Tobias mentioned the BizSpark program,
mm-hmm.
Which I then, you know, applied for and got into. And yeah.
Yeah. And as you were going through that process, what resources did you guys go for?
So, again, BizSpark was great because we could leverage Azure in that system.
Yeah.
And that's nice because it's free for us and allows us to focus on developing the front end and the back end and putting all of our resources and time into that aspect of the business. As far as the back end system, we're using Postgres. So, again, it's free, it's scalable, it's a well-known relational database.
Well, for me, the big thing was I had a lot of theoretical experience coming out of college, but not a lot of practical experience.
Mm.
So to me, a discovery was like in the first week of like looking up, well, what do we need to do to make this, you know, catalog app on Android that you do in fact build a server client system, which I've never done before. So then I discovered what a RESTful web service was and then built one. And what particularly I found attractive about Azure is the whole infrastructure as a service aspect of it, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need our own servers, and scalability is built in. Pay-as-you-go aspect of it, while it's just a test server for me to use, it's free. As we get pick up clients, then the payment comes in. And furthermore, it's kind of the flexibility. I knew some technologies coming out of college. I worked on Postgres pretty in depth. I worked on Android. Azure IC provides its own database services and its own kind of abstracted away from the whole visual machine aspect of it, web app things, but those are in the Visual Studio infrastructure ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And they're done through C#, something that regretfully I'm not that familiar with.
Not
and
necessarily, but I can understand the misinterpretation, because it is very kind of like a service that you're kind of interacting with, and when you start thinking services from Microsoft, you kind of get that C# thing in your head. But I think that really interesting thing about the infrastructure as a service, where you're saying you're able to kind of abstract away that kind of work that you'd have to go manage servers or go tell somebody that they need to turn on their computer or go have to hard reset something someplace. But
yeah,
basically you have that all just kind of through this portal that you can manage.
And yeah.
And learning that that's something that you have available to you makes, you know, makes that just not an issue for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So
because again, for us, we want to run things as lean as possible.
Yeah.
I'm funding the whole thing.
Right.
So the least work and time that I can get away with, you know, as long as it's stable and quality service, the best, you know.
And the less time I spend learning new technologies, as opposite to ones that I'm extremely familiar with,
yeah,
the faster we can get to market.
Yeah, yeah, because going on to this project, I before did a lot of work in Android work in Eclipse, and Android Studio Beta just came out.
Yeah.
Kind of when I got on, so it was my first kind of jump into Android Studio, and it being dedicated to Android, unlike Eclipse, it's just a lot easier to work with, a lot faster to work with.
Yeah.
Easier to get, you know.
And so that
kind of
like resonates with that. We're just using the systems that are already in place to make this build cycle so we can make something, right? You know,
mm-hmm,
that's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And right out of college, you guys, lean budget, you know, you got to make something actually happen.
Yeah.
So it's cool, you know, you brought an Android app to market, and it's on that Android store right now?
It is, it's free. It's running the database. It lets you access 55,000 bikes across 400 brands, and we're continually adding more.
So 55,000 bikes, and when I first met you guys, that was the thing that kind of stood out to me. How did you guys go about collecting all that data?
So we started out actually with way less than that. So we had to make one company, and we targeted the biggest bicycle manufacturers because they make the most bikes per year. So the theory goes that those are the ones that the most cyclists will own models for. And even that proved to be a challenge because manually entering all of Trek bicycles from 1976 up to now is a lot of work per bicycle. It's like 20 data points at least. I ended up meeting Greg LeMond on a San Francisco ride. He's a Tour de France winner. And I ended up just focusing on his bikes because for a short period of time, he was a subsidiary brand of Trek. So we shipped with what may be like just a little over 100 bicycles under Le Mans.
I was like 300 or something.
Okay. Well,
so started with 300 bicycles.
Yeah, it was a lot of just manually entering data from, you know, PDFs and things like that. It just took a long time.
Yeah. And
yeah,
our search wasn't like a general search. It was like look at Le Mans bikes or something like that. Originally it was written out. It was pretty bad. And that was done with our own tools that we wrote. And
yeah, I wrote a tool for it, actually in parallel to developing the backend.
Yeah.
Because when we started entering them, we had no backend. So wrote a tool that basically let Seven over here and a couple of friends that we subcontracted type in this thing from a downloaded PDF that, if you was lucky, wasn't, you know, pixelated and low res.
Or in German or whatever.
Yeah.
So it started there.
Yeah,
we started not
just
even.
Hard entry.
Mm-hmm.
And then where have you guys kind of moved to now?
So as the internet happened, companies that make bikes brought their archives online. But that's only around 2001 if you're lucky.
Mm.
All the older bikes are still predominantly locked in PDFs all over the place. So it's actually a dual pipeline where for older bikes, me and data entry contractors just sit there with PDFs on one half the screen and our data entry front end on the other half the screen retyping everything manually.
Mm.
And on newer bikes, we write scrapers actively that allow us to go to sites like Trek, go into their archives, which are all, you know, in a standardized pattern and just scrape that in. And then even when we do that, we have to do a significant amount of data correction and modification to make it fit.
How many people are in your company right now?
It fluctuates up and down. It's been as much as 10 at one point, and now it's something like 4.
Yeah. I think it's kind of interesting how you guys have been kind of dynamically, you know, you've been willing to be very lean and be like, you know, we need 10 people to do all this data entry and do all this other crap, but let's slim it back down and figure out how we're going to do the next project.
Well, honestly, what I've learned so far is it doesn't work because I think part of the reason apps like this haven't happened is because a lot of people, when they go at making a bicycle app to make cycling more prevalent, they try to do something like a data tracker or a map app or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doing data entry and a significantly built out database of technical information is really hard because it requires specialized knowledge.
Yeah.
And so to that aspect, I tried to hire data entry people that weren't familiar with bicycling and weren't familiar with bicycle mechanics specifically. So they proved to enter data too slowly and with too many errors. So it resulted in me spending more time correcting their data than actually entering data the first time correctly.
Yeah.
And then my second attempt was to hire a bunch of contractors from Ukraine. Well, while they were charging me less than half of what American contractors I was able to get at, they were still entering it incorrectly, you
mm-hmm.
know? So even at those rates, it wasn't cost effective.
Yeah. So it's just like very challenging, you know, going from no aggregation of very separate data that in a lot of ways these companies might not want in one place. You guys are kind of breaking the mold and saying, we're going to do the hard work for you, the user, you know, and then present it in a way that's reasonable. So you worked on the front end a lot. How are you guys breaking all of this data into something usable?
So we have our front page is more of just we have the Sprocket blog on Instagram, which you know, Seven he posts pictures up there. It's just something so when you go into the app, it's not just stale same information, same words.
Yeah.
So you got some new, you know, he posts picture parts, all that stuff. So we got there's just something fresh on the front. We also then we have our catalog search. You can go into the search, you can go into our catalog, you have all of the bikes by brand or manufacturer, and then click manufacturer, it goes to all the years. You can choose your year, you can then get, you know, choose that bicycle from that year, and it brings us to just a bicycle page that has all the parts, lists all the parts for it.
So for every single bike in every single year,
all 55,000,
you can drill down and see all the parts that went into that bike.
Yeah,
we're going to be working on hopefully this year being able to filter it a little better, filter by bicycle type, by, you know, just as many different, you know, filters as we can think of, you know, make it easier for people to find.
I think that kind of like nails down that culture of bicycling where you have, you know, what's new. I like the idea of bringing what you're already posting into the frame, but also providing such richness of like, you get really geeky about bike stuff, I'm assuming.
Oh yeah.
So
I don't think I do
having
do
that. Yeah, having that as an availability just seems like it just kind of goes hand in hand. Like, you know, if you're going to be part of the culture and you're going to go to the bike parties and all that stuff, you might want to look at, you know, the 22 parts that went into the 1977 bike that you're interested in buying.
Yeah, I mean, it helps you make decisions such as, you know, when your chains are tubes were down. You can find what diameter your wheels are. You can find out what kind of speeds your bike supports, which lets you make a determination what chain is appropriate to buy for your bike.
Yeah.
There are a lot of issues, especially on older 80s bikes, which are really popular because they're low cost and high quality production, where seat post sizes are actually hard to find because they weren't standardized yet.
Yeah.
So I've been in situations where I've rammed the seat tube in on the incorrect diameter and spent half a day pulling it out.
Yeah.
I've been in situations where the seat tube was a few millimeters too small, so it ended up kind of, you know, sagging in as I rode along.
Yeah.
And just having that information available, I think, makes it easier to get into cycling and makes it so that cyclists can spend less time worrying about all that stuff and more time actually riding.
So,
and that's also what goes into the whole data entry by hand thing, which, despite the fact that we've kind of scraped in a lot of the information age era, the 80s seat tubes that Sona's talking about are not going to be there.
Yeah.
So that's mostly the thing that we're trying to add, and why this manual entry pipeline that we have still persists, even though we have by now 55,000 bikes. And
yeah.
There's also a lot of things that we have to take into account, like the way that we structure the data. What's been interesting is learning about how databases work and how our database interacts with our front end through Microsoft, because our data model wasn't exactly accurate to what we ended up needing, so we're having to adjust it on the fly. And for example, I think we screwed up wheels, so we have a wheel card that has all the information about a wheel, but we actually need to break it down into, you know, like spokes, front wheel, rear wheel, front hub, rear hub, things like that. We had a partner approach us that makes electric bikes, and so that requires a whole new card of electric bike parts, you know, speedometer, battery, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. All these layers.
And it's great, though, because, I mean, we do have our normal builds, like we're working on our marketplace build right now, we're adding a bunch of marketplace features, but with entering the bikes manually in the way, you know, database setup, we can, I mean, it's like making micro updates all the time. So like when we enter a bike, it's, you know, it's in the app already. So
yeah.
So even if we're not like putting up large updates as often as we would like, then we can still have a lot of, you know, daily updates if we wanted to, for, you know, entering bikes in daily.
Right.
So there's
And then kind of moving on to the back end. What do you guys have going on powering the app from behind?
Well, the main thing is an Azure VM, which is mostly a full-fledged VM because it allowed me at the time to dive right into the back-end design without having to learn necessarily new technologies.
Which kind of operating system is there in it?
It is Windows Server 2008.
Okay.
We provisioned it right before Windows 10 hit the market. Haven't felt the need to update yet. And on that, I have Tomcat running with Postgres. And Tomcat is the actual lightweight web app that processes the requests and transforms them into SQL queries that the database fulfills.
Yeah. And so you guys hit it from the Android app like an API.
Mm-hmm.
Tomcat manages that for you.
Yeah, Tomcat presents a RESTful API to the internet.
Okay, cool. And how many, so Postgres tables, non-table storage?
Table storage.
Table storage. How many tables do you guys have?
I can't remember the schema that we have.
About seven or so.
Seven tables?
Yeah. Of which there's two main ones, the one that contains the bicycle headers.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like air model, which is the 55,000 bikes, and then there's the giant parts table, which last I looked had 100,000 parts in it.
Yeah.
Which contains all of the parts of the bicycle.
Actually, one of the issues we ran into is, like, as we're pulling in all these bikes, we're not keeping in mind to place the same parts in the same places, because different data sources might have the same part written in different ways, either with capitalization or, you know, the brand model might be reversed, or it might be a typo or something.
Yeah.
So that
it could
challenge.
Point to different parts.
Yeah.
Two bikes could have the same.
more like for every of those parts, there might be, 20 to 50 instances in some cases of the same thing.
Yeah.
So.
And each bike that you pulled out labeled it differently.
Yeah.
And so you end up having very redundant parts.
Huh. Yeah, and there's some theories on how we could go by automating and doing data cleaning on that information, but ultimately it's one of our challenges going forward probably this year to make that data available so that when you're both looking at a bike, you can tap through into a parts page
mm-hmm.
for that part and find out its specific details, but also so that as we approach the release of a marketplace build where we allow users to buy and sell bikes,
yeah.
we can also then, in a future update, allow them to buy and sell bike parts
mm-hmm.
as well.
So that was kind of my next question, like what's new and what's next for
yeah.
you guys?
I'm glad you asked.
Yeah.
Well, the marketplace build. So we're kind of pivoting to a monetization scheme where we're a free app providing information that's really hard to find for bicycle mechanics and amateurs, but now we're going to be connecting those bicyclists to each other because we see that there's a strong need to buy and sell that is not being adequately serviced by eBay and Craigslist. Like eBay and Craigslist, they're trying to figure out, if you want to sell like a couch, a bike, a TV, or something else, whereas this is a very specialized experience, very well-designed app, and we are just facilitating the exchange of bicycles, and so in that way we can get really granular with our filters,
yeah.
and
you can do it better.
Yeah,
well, that's great because since we're, right now it's only selling bikes, then the bikes are still all broken up by parts. So if you're selling a bicycle, and the handlebars are a little messed up, you can actually make a little note for each individual part on like the condition of the part, or if you just replace that part.
Yeah. Pull in the part that you replaced it with.
Right, so.
Frankenbike type thing.
So then you just get a lot more information usually than on Craigslist, because usually on Craigslist they don't necessarily address all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you don't know what bike you have, in the current release we're about to ship this month, you'll have the ability to look up your bike in our database. If it exists in our database, you can hit the sell button right there, and then you can enter any notes for anything that is not ship shop shape or anything that you've modified on it. In a future release, in a couple of months down the road, we'll be allowing you to make a custom bicycle entry. So that means, as soon as you go into that mode, you'll be able to take camera photos of your bike
yeah.
and then write a custom part entry from the start. And moving beyond that, as you mentioned, our community is something we want to grow, and our data is something that is such a massive problem that I think for our lean startup, there's only so much we can do in that regard. So
yeah.
we want to bring in users and help us enter that data.
Yeah.
So as they're both listing bikes for sale, we can have a validation process, and also we aim to have a kind of Wikipedia style experience where our users are with our database, so they can also engage and be a part of the community and help other people save time.
So the back end guy sitting here, just what are you thinking about as he just keeps throwing out, oh, we're just gonna add
knows,
a couple more hundred pieces of data. You,
I mean, don't look at me, look at the UI guy. I'm good.
You're good.
All I need is one handle on my server to let them post a part.
Yeah.
So as far as like features, I always make sure to keep my co-founder looped in and make sure that he knows what I'm thinking of building, so that he can set up the back end
yeah.
and any of the front end components to support that. And
right.
then as far as me, I'm a pretty good UXer, so it's just a matter of getting there and getting through all the other priority features that we have on the roadmap.
Yeah.
And another thing that should be of concern to me, but isn't so much, is scalability, obviously, as this market is going to come, is the community hopefully is going to take off. Well, because of, the overall architecture, the entire thing is eminently scalable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Postgres has been built that way for decades to
mm-hmm.
be able to, perform a search out of a table of a million parts for me in 31 milliseconds. Tomcat is great with its database connection pooling, and should all of that fail, I just provision another virtual machine, create myself an availability set.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's been a theme for our company is not only are we lean, but we aim to make a high quality structure, both in our design and our developer end, because what we build out now is what we want to be using in 10 years. We don't want to be changing an engine mid-flight, sort of like...
So scalability was thought of from day one. That's
yeah.
why it's not a concern.
Yeah.
UI's just changed all the time. I mean, we're always
well,
adding, we're always adding. Okay, so, well, you make...
I keep trying to isolate things, so...
Right, no, it's good, because, I mean, things like the bicycle catalog, I don't need to make updates. It's pretty much done. As we add bikes, it, you know, it just scales, and it's fine. I mean, obviously, we're adding, we want to keep adding more, you know, features and stuff to the app, so there's a lot of that, but, so it's kind of a, it's, we're kind of caught in between, since, me and, we have a couple people who help out with Android every once in a while. It's still a lot of work for, do we, add more features to it, or do you know, do we update the app to the newest material design?
Yeah.
It's
kind of trade-offs there.
A lot of trade-off, yeah. Sometimes I get an update, sometimes I update design, sometimes it's updating the, or adding more features, and it's moving along. I mean, it's a lot of work, but we're getting there.
I think it's been pretty good in terms of your experience. You can speak to how backwards compatibility has been working with Android, and how we've been able to kind of leverage a lot of the standard systems in Android without having to build things from scratch.
Right, and it's with a lot of using a lot of Google's or Android's app compat library to, you know, go back to Kit or pre KitKat. Post 4.1 something, yeah. So that's been great, because I mean it's worked pretty well with making things backwards compatible. I mean, we're kind of running into some RAM issues. Some of the older phones that only have like a gig or less of RAM, it's a little tough. We have to limit some of the data, that we show.
So you guys are going to continue to move forward, and hopefully you guys come back in a year and we have another discussion about, you know, how it went. Do you guys have any movie recommendations, podcast recommendations, book recommendations? That's how we usually kind of finish off. Things that people should go investigate before they go, you know, try to build something that's never been built before.
For Android design, Google Material Design Guidelines. There's also Google I/O videos on design.
Yeah, I mean, Google has their entire Android, you know, development or whatever.
I mean, more on like a personal level. What inspired you? You know, what do you think is formational to who you are, maybe, that you'd recommend other people kind of experience?
I think you should get a bike and you should go ride it. And if you can, like me, give up your car. See how it goes. Try it out.
Favorite movie? Favorite book?
I mean, Die Hard's a classic.
Die Hard, yeah. There you go. That's a good one.
On a more serious note, my side hobby has always been history.
Yeah.
So, Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, can't recommend it highly enough.
Okay.
I'm a big sci-fi guy, so I'm liking all this new technology, all these new stuff coming out, and I like exploring, you know, just all the new technology. And sci-fi, Star Wars, Star Trek, I like all of it.
Yeah.
And The Matrix is a big inspiration for me. That's one of my favorite movies.
Okay, cool. All right. Thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks for your time.
Look forward to talking to you guys soon.
Thanks.
Yeah.